Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 201 of the Diecast Movie Podcast. Diecast Movie Podcast is a movie podcast where we do movie discussions where the genre of the movies decided by the role of a die, and we also do interviews. And today's episode is an interview with Christine Parker, and I hope you guys enjoy it. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do two types of episodes. One, where we do roll a die to decide what genre the movie we're going to discuss. The other one is an interview, and today we're doing an interview with independent filmmaker Christine Parker, who's known for Blood of the Mummy, 400 Ways to Kill, and also her production company, Sick Chick Flicks. Which I love that name. It's a cool name. How you doing today, Christine?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm doing good. Glad to be here.
And you and I are talking just before we recorded. The day before we recorded this, you just finished the Sick Chick Flicks Film Festival, which was like a 12-hour-ish event. How did it go? How was it?
It was fantastic. One thing I love about our festival is we get a good amount of filmmakers that come out for it. And that's really the best part. I mean, aside from the amazing films that they've made, just getting to know these filmmakers and talking to them and just discussing, you know, how we feel about making our movies and showing things from the women's perspective. It's just fantastic. I love these people.
And so what kind of movies did you have at this year's festival or the typical festival? What kind of genres?
We have horror, sci-fi, and fantasy films. So the big three, in my opinion.
I'm not going to argue with you there because I enjoy all three of those. But our podcast is multi-genre, so we hit them all. But those three seem to come up the most. Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing the film festival?
7 years now.
And this is located at where for people to know for next year?
We're doing it at the Varsity Theater in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Awesome. And if people want to go to next year's festival, I guess it would be around the same time and they could follow you on what, Facebook or online at Sick Chick Flicks Film Festival?
Yep, sickchickflicksfilmfestival.com. We haven't set the dates for next year, but it should be early October probably again.
Okay, now, which film won the festival? You know, I'm just curious.
Okay, so we have a Sick Chick Flicks Award, and that's for the one that has the most women behind the scenes, you know, in key production roles, and that went to Chick. That won the best Sick Chick Flicks film. And then we had a one for our best feature film. We only showed the one feature that won, and that was for Sins of the Father. And then the best short film went to Kickstart My Heart.
And Chicks also won for best horror film in that genre category too, right?
Yes, it did.
Cool. I was noticing when I looked at the winners, which you have on your Facebook page, it seemed like all the awards except for one, it was a different film. There was only one where you had the same film twice, and that was Chicks won the Sick Chicks Flick Award and the best horror, but everything else was a lot of different films involved, which I think shows you had a good crop.
We did. We got, well, you know, our submissions was like about a year and a half this time, because when we did it last year, we did it in February. So there was like a long amount of time between, you know, that one and this film festival. So we had over 100 entries and we only picked like 40 something films. So we definitely had the cream of the crop.
Now, I looked at the schedule and the way it works, and you have a block every hour straight through for 12, well, like 11 hours, and I think the last part is the award ceremony or something like that.
Yeah.
Does anybody make it all the way through just going through just how many people sit through all the blocks? I mean, I would assume some people have to go eat lunch, but I mean, there's always those diehards. I'm wondering how many diehards do you typically get that go for the full 12 hours?
Well, I mean, this was our first time doing it all in one day. So this was a new experience. We didn't have very many people left at the end. I mean, just a few of the filmmakers were there. But I'm hoping, you know, I think maybe we should give an audience award for the audience member that sticks through the whole 12 hours. You know, I think that would be a good thing to have. Maybe motivate them.
It could be a motivation. And I mean, that, I can only imagine, you know, 12 hours. That is a bladder bursting if you made it through all the way. I mean, I guess it'd be like a big, like the Depends Award.
Well, now we do have, you know, small breaks between. Some of them had, you know, about 10, sometimes 15 minutes between the blocks. So there's enough time to go to the bathroom.
That's true. That's true. That is fair. Yeah. I was going for a joke. I shouldn't have done that. But I'm glad it seems like you had a good time, and I hope and you're giving the spotlight to independent filmmakers that are trying to make that start, because without these festivals, it's hard for them to get that their whole thing going, their whole career going.
Yeah. And we had a few people, it was either their first film or their first film festival they'd ever been to, and they were just so excited to see it in an actual theater up on a big screen. Really validated them as filmmakers.
I've gone to film festivals, and I think that's one of the fun things is when you get to see it and then you get to talk to the filmmaker themselves in between, and you can just see him beaming like a parent seeing their child finally getting shown the way it was meant to be on the big screen. And sadly, for some of these shorts, or that might be the only time they ever get seen, is at festivals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I, as a filmmaker myself, I know how it feels. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful feeling. And just to hear the audience responding in all the right places, you know, laughing at the spots you thought were funny and you were hoping everybody else thought was funny, you know.
That is true. And what led you to become a filmmaker? You know, what was the passion you developed when you were younger and you just decided to pursue it when you got older? Or was it something you happened into later in life? I don't know. What led you to want to go down this path of, you know, not wanting to make any money and just have to toil constantly making things work for the love of it?
Well, I mean, I've always been creative and I've always loved telling stories. As far as the filmmaking part goes, I mean, that just kind of happened. I mean, when I was a kid, we would do puppet shows and plays and stuff like that. And I was involved with theater a little bit, but, I had gotten into graphic design and was a graphic designer, and that kind of led me into doing, you know, videos. Digital video came along. It was so much easier than, you know, film to actually make a movie. And then I read this wonderful book, If Chins Could Kill, by Bruce Campbell. And just the whole vibe of making an independent film and what they went through, the whole process, I was like, that is something that I really think I would love to do. So I went back to school and I studied, basically it was like a broadcast technology degree, but it taught me all about directing and editing, the different editing systems, the different cameras, shooting on camera. And, you know, from there, it just kind of happened that one of our professors, one of our teachers, wanted to make a short zombie film, because his class was really boring and he was trying to spice it up for us. So I volunteered to write a script, and we made the film together, and I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. In fact, for a very long time, the same group of people that made that short film worked together and started making other movies with me.
I find that with a lot of filmmakers, whether they're independent or moved on to the bigger productions, they a lot of times have a core group that they work with for a long period of time, stick together, and everybody develops that shorthand and basically improves at the same rate.
Yeah, it's fun. Oh, and Bill Mulligan was the one that has been there from the very beginning. So, and he's stuck it out no matter what I put him through.
Oh, come on now. We know you're gifted because you actually make Bill look good on screen. And I mean, that's not a small feat.
It isn't a small feat. You know, when I remember to turn the camera on, he looks really good.
I'm sure you remember to turn the camera on. I can't imagine you leaving any good, you know, scenes of Bill like never being shot.
Oh, I've missed so many really good opportunities with him. Like that time when he drove the isopropyl alcohol. You know, I wish I had had the camera rolling on that one because that was priceless. I was just too busy laughing at him as he suffered.
Well, you got to suffer for your art, right?
You do, yes. It makes it more worthwhile.
Now, you're based down in North Carolina, and I find it interesting, you know, a lot of people don't think of North Carolina as this hotbed for independent filmmaking, but I mean, I guess every state has independent filmmakers in it. But I mean, how did you find the other people? Like when you started the festival and you found all these kindred spirits, cause I know Bill's down there and there's special effects people down there that I've talked to in the past and all that. Mm-hmm. Thing. So how did this all, like, was it something you just went into and there was already these people there and you got the network with?
Well, I mean, for the first couple of films that I did, I was doing just about everything. And we were all learning as we went. So we really didn't know what we were doing at first, you know. And we've all just kind of educated ourselves on how to make movies. And it was just going to film festivals where we met other filmmakers. We started, you know, networking with them. And I know Bill's worked with quite a few other filmmakers. And finding special effects people to help us out. And, you know, it's just been, it's mostly the festivals and the conventions we've been to that we've found other people that would lend something to our craft.
And I think that's probably the more fun way of doing it is you get some tips, but you learn on your own and then you develop it.
Yeah.
I think that's the more fun way of learning.
Yeah, it is. It's not so great sometimes because your films aren't that great at first, but that, I mean, they always say you have to make a few bad films to make a good film. You know, you have to make some mistakes and learn from your mistakes and then move forward.
I think so. And if you're able to learn from them, that's the key thing. There's some people that repeat it and repeat it, but eventually you learn like, wait, oh, we're supposed to do, oh, if we would have did it this way, it would have been, the shot would have been so much nicer if we'd have just had the camera like a little bit different or a little different lens or the lighting would have been different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, you probably didn't have everything you needed equipment-wise right off the bat. So sometimes there's certain things you knew probably right away. Oh, I wish I had this, but mm-hmm. you have what you have.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we just basically had a camera and a microphone. And then I had to learn, you know, what to do with the footage, how to dump the footage. You know, some of it I had learned in college, but there was a whole realm of other stuff that's completely different from broadcast technology, of course. So you have to learn about the storytelling and the best way to convey things and definitely lighting. Lighting was a really big thing that we learned about.
As I will say, when I watch some independent films, lighting to me is such a big thing, and I can tell somebody's when they, you can see it when you're watching the work. And I like to watch like early stuff, middle great, like middle of the time, and then later on, so I can see the progression of a filmmaker. And you can see when, oh, they got the equipment and now they're putting the lighting in, or they got better mics and everything is hitting on those cylinders. And that's why I always tell people when you go back to look at somebody's early work, yes, they're learning, but also you got to take into account the equipment they had available when they're filming. They don't have everything off the get-go.
Yeah, and just the transition from standard definition to HD, you know, the cameras that we used to use were just standard definition. Then we had to buy, you know, the more advanced cameras to keep up with everybody else because that's what people wanted, especially if you were going to get distribution, you had to have HD. So, yeah, everything changed so much during the span of like, it's been about 20 years we've been making movies.
And I know some of your movies are very easy to find and some of them I had a little trouble finding, you know, to do just because it's the nature of the beast and or time to watch them all because you've done quite a few different ones.
I've done a lot.
Yes. you've directed at least, what, a Baker's Dozen. of films. Yeah. And then if you had cinematography in, and you've done a few more and stuff like that. So you've done, I guess, what, close to 20 films?
Probably close to that. And it's like 5 features, I believe. So, yeah.
And what I love about it is you mix in the shorts with the features, because I hate it when people take a short, a material for a short, and they try to make it into a feature, you know, instead of just making it with the length it was meant to be, what the story should be told. I'm glad that you stay with, you know, you mix in both genres, both time frames.
Except for my first one. That was a longer version of a short film I did, Second Death. So, but we didn't do it after that. Yeah. All the others have just been either short stories as told as a short story and then features.
Well, I mean, that's been part of the learning. You realize, you know, when the feedback and stuff like that. So what else did you learn from that first film?
Oh my gosh. I learned so much. I learned, you know, a lot of it was not just the actual filmmaking, but working with people. And I've always been kind of an introverted person. So being in a position where I was kind of in charge and directing a movie was really intimidating to me. And I learned that you can't let them know that you don't know what you're doing. That if you just BS your way through it and act like you know what you're doing, then people will follow you. So I learned a lot about that. And then I learned about raising money. Back then they didn't have Indiegogo and stuff. So we would raise money by selling credits on eBay and raised a good amount of money to get the film done. And it's amazing to me that we even got distribution on that first film. I guess there weren't a lot of independent filmmakers in the mix at that time. But we did get distribution, and we actually made a little bit of money off of it, which was surprising. Somebody who really helped me a lot was a guy named Pericles Loomes. He did Redneck Zombies. Mm-hmm. He was the director of that. And we became friends online, and he gave me so much great advice on distribution and what the distributors were looking for and editing and all sorts of things. And he actually got a role in my second film, Fistful of Rain.
Yeah, I remember seeing his name when I was watching the film. You're looking at the opening credits, and I saw Pericles. I'm like, that's a name you don't see often. It's just...
No.
Except when I'm reading a Greek history, you know, it's just like,
not too many people named Pericles.
Which I think is a great name to have for acting or stage, whatever, because people will remember you. And some people say, oh no, you need something that's easy. It's like, I don't know, I'm going the other way nowadays. It's like, if your name is Pericles, you remember that.
He didn't even use that name for Redneck Zombies, though. He went under a different name.
Well, I just remember when I saw it for Fistful of Brain. I mean, forever.
Yeah, for Fistful of Brains, we used his real name.
Yeah, that's when I remember seeing it. And I was just like,
yeah.
What? And it was kind of interesting with Fistful of Brains. I like how you did the opening with the music. I love the opening song. And
thanks.
I really enjoy it because it's like the song sets the tone. And most movies, you don't get the full, like, you know, you get part of the song, but I think you played the whole song and you had everybody.
The whole song. Yeah. And Bill was like, do you really have to play the whole song? I was like, yeah, if I want to play the whole song, they wrote that song just for us and I want to play it. So we did.
I can see both sides of this. I enjoyed it and I liked the whole song, and I enjoyed seeing like all the cast members shown. You had a night, so you knew who went with what, you know, actor and actress with the pictures. But I can also see Bill coming from that point of view. Because you don't usually get a whole song, right? Except for James Bond movies. But I enjoyed the song. So I think if you're into the song, you're not going to mind, because the song, I liked it. I enjoyed it. And if you give permission, I'll probably put that at the end of the episode. So if people want to hear the song, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's fine with me. We love Blister. Those are the guys that wrote the song. So Yeah. And then Kiff did the one at the end. Apologist for Fools.
Well, that's the weakness of being at the end. I didn't listen to the whole song at the end part. So I'll go back and listen to. I could have lied. But I'm being truthful. You know, when you get to the end, and it was a long day. I was just like, okay, I'm done. And you know, the movie was over, and I was just like, okay, you know. Yeah. But now I have a reason to go back.
There you go.
Now, for Fistful of Brains, obviously, the name implies that you're going for a little bit of the spaghetti western type motif right off the get-go. So what was it like? Because you really embraced the western thing. So you had the prop guns and all the other stuff going on and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was just amazing. They would tell you as a first-time filmmaker, you shouldn't do period pieces, but I didn't know that at the time. So I just went ahead and made one. I just thought it would be really something unique to do a zombie Western because, you know, I hadn't really seen anybody else doing anything like that. And I did want to just be a cookie cutter filmmaker, you know? So I decided to do a zombie Western before I had a Western town. So then we had to find a place where we could shoot it. And we found this place. It was Wild Bill's Western town called Shadowhawk. And he had built it in his backyard, basically. It's like at the end of this cul-de-sac out in Brogdon, which is near Smithfield, North Carolina. And he built an entire Western town with saloons and everything. And he was actually in the movie, Bill Drake. He was an old Hollywood actor. He'd done small parts in a lot of Western films and Western TV series. I think he was in a couple episodes of Gunsmoke, too.
Really?
Yeah, so it was just like, a wonderful thing to find this guy with this Western town.
I was going to say the set was great. I was just like, this is a low budget. Cause I'm watching it, you know, I'm like, okay, low budget. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
This set looks good. I mean, you know, for low budget, there's low, you know exactly what I mean. There's low budget sets and then there's low budget sets. This was like, definitely looked like you were getting bang for the buck, whatever you did. And obviously you lucked into, finding the right setup with Bill Drake.
Yeah, he gave us a really good deal on the town, the rental, as long as we put him in it. And then we also agreed to help him direct his first film. So we went back and made a film with him, and he edited the whole thing himself. I mean, which is amazing. He'd never done anything like that before, but it turned out really good.
All right, I got to ask, what role did Bill Drake play?
He was the sheriff, the old sheriff, I think, or the sheriff deputy. He was an old guy.
The sheriff deputy.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because he was really good.
Yeah, because he
and then a bunch of his friends were in it, too. So, yeah, we had a whole cast of characters.
He did a good job of acting, because I didn't remember the actor until you said it, but the thing was, he stood out where he was the one who told Jack to, oh, you're going to stay in the jail. Like, oh, let me out. No, and he takes all the guns and he's like, I got a bad feeling about this. Why do I have to go first? Because I'm the sheriff, you're the deputy. You know, poor guy. And I was hoping, it was one of those guys, you knew he was going to die, but you were hoping he would make it longer. You know, it's.
I know, yeah.
But do they really die? They just become living in a different way.
That's right.
I guess you could say, which is the kind of the whole point of the movie. But it's
obviously,
I know you wrote the script, and there are a lot of puns in here, and definitely a lot of humor, which I could tell you're loving. I mean, obviously, we had the sheriff, you know, T.W. Earp, which, you know,
Twerp,
which killed the first pastor. You know, so I'm not spoiling anything there because that happened early in the movie, and it's kind of a flashback.
Yeah.
So what was it like with some of the humorous elements you came up? Because you came up with one that you know some people could find rather controversial of humor. I enjoyed it. I'm Catholic, but I enjoyed it. But I could see some people. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pastor John, you know,
Pastor John, yeah. I was just, you know, inspired by the hypocrisy of some religious people, you know. So that's what inspired me. And you see that kind of as a theme throughout the whole thing. But, yeah, I mean, I don't remember exactly, you know, why I came up with some of the jokes I did. A lot of it was probably just conversations with friends that when we were talking about doing the movie and we should do this or we should do that, you know. I'm sure Bill had his hand in that, and some of them. He's got a good sense of humor.
He does. I mean, it's just, I'm just thinking, Pastor John, for listeners on the, he's interesting. You know, he is an interesting character.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Wayne Bates was the guy that played him, and he's a really good actor. He's been in a couple of my films.
I guess the only hint I could tell people is Pastor John probably likes Lady Godiva chocolate.
Yeah, there you go.
I think that'll be a big enough hint for people. Edward Warner as Lazarus / Deadeye, the two characters there. I was loving him. You know, he was bringing a great like sense of fun and joy of this, of playing those two characters, but especially Deadeye.
Yes, he was the perfect Deadeye. And he's one that was with me since The Second Death, my very first film. We were partners for a little while, but yeah, nobody else could have played Deadeye like he did.
He has that carny at the total playoff where he's tricking you. You go for it anyway because of the charisma.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I enjoyed the movie. I mean, it was interesting how you went through and you took through, and I could see where you had some limitations was you had a lot of people and with the effects. And but I liked the chattering of one of the groups of zombies that were going on where they're doing that teeth chattering thing. I thought that was kind of intimidating and things like that because it set them different with, and also you had the different visuals with the makeup.
Yeah. I wanted to, you know, kind of do like a Native American type vibe, you know, and how they would intimidate the villagers and the people they were coming after to just add a real kind of creepy factor to it. And I thought the teeth chattering like, you know, you're getting ready to get eaten or whatever, you know, would be really creepy.
And you have a lot of people playing zombies. I mean, you must have had people calling their friends. Who wants to be a zombie?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I could not believe how many people. Well, I mean, you say, you know, zombie Western, you get to go hang out in a Western town and dress up in period clothing. You get a lot of people interested. Anytime we had a call for zombies, we had a lot of people show up. Everybody wants to be a zombie and die horribly or whatever, you know. So we spent so much time making up those people. I think we must have had close to 100 extras show up one day, over one weekend. It was a lot of fun.
It was one of those things because, you know, again, with lower budget, you don't know. Like sometimes you'll get six zombies and they're all like running around and making it look like they're more, but they're like, the way the shot's going, you can tell these are a lot of zombies here. That was really nice because it makes it feel like a zombie horde should feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole march of zombies was a lot of fun to do. They really got into it.
The costuming was very good too. You know, again, for a low budget film, you felt it was period costuming. I'm we're on a Zoom call and I can see behind Christine and I can see she's got costumes behind her. So I'm assuming that you did some of the costuming yourself.
I did not actually. I have not started sewing period costumes until a couple of years ago.
Wow.
So at the time we had somebody else. She was the grandmother of the lead actress. And she had done a lot of Civil War reenactment stuff, so she knew the period. So she's the one that did a lot of the outfits.
Well, she did a great job, and that kind of thing.
She did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love the guy that played the sheriff, Daryl Parker, too. He was just, you hated him. You just hated him.
He's a very good villain, for sure.
And for listeners who haven't seen it, you should go see it. And we won't spoil it for you, but there is a sequel. Of course.
Yeah, there is.
A Few Brains More, Summer of Blood.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in that one, I noticed that the lead actor and actress are both different. You have different people playing Lily and Jack. And I guess because you know, people moved on and went to different, because you were talking of a several year gap, I think, in between the two.
Yeah, there was a few years between, and we did have a few issues on set with the actors that led us to have to replace them. We actually had shot footage with the previous actors, so we had to reshoot all that stuff. Fortunately, we weren't too far into it when they left. But that, as easy and fun as Fistful of Brains was, A Few Brains More was a lot more stressful, a lot more stressful. But I think it turned out better. And I think it turned out really good. I really loved the new leads that we had in it. They're really wonderful actors.
Yeah, I agree. I think they both, sometimes when you replace people, it affects negatively, but I thought they both did well. You know, I'm not gonna, you know, and did a good job with it. And of course, you still had Edward Warner back as Deadeye, which you had to have. You had to have Deadeye.
Of course, nobody else could have played that part. Yeah.
I mean, you know, even if you would have died, you'd have to bring him back as a zombie just so he could play a zombie.
Yeah.
And then you brought in Bill Mulligan, you know, in that movie, because he wasn't in the first one as an actor, but he was in this one as an actor.
Yeah, we'll see. The difference there is in this movie, we wrote it together. So he wrote a part for himself, of course.
Oh, so he's like a little Orson Welles. It's like, if you want me to direct, I have to be in it too.
Yeah. I'm like, we're writing, you know, we go back and forth, and then I see this whole scene with this Dr. Vesavius. And I was like, wait a minute, where did this come from? And he said, well, you know, I just thought it would be really cool to have this character. And yeah, I want to play this character. Like, all right, Bill, you wrote yourself a part. That's okay.
Well, okay, I guess you could say it's the cause. Well, you know, he really wanted lime snow cones. You know, you should have paid him in lime snow cones.
That's what I should have done. Well, I didn't pay him at all, so he just did it for the heck of it.
For listeners who don't know what lime snow cones mean, if you see the movie, you'll get the reference. In, you know.
They're Lasbury lime.
But I like it because you take the zombies, the storyline goes from the Western and it moves into the Summer of Love, the 60s, and you basically got like your version of what if the zombies hit Woodstock?
Yeah. That was some of the inspiration for it. You know, like, don't eat the green snow cones, man. They're bad, you know. But that was a lot of fun doing those scenes, the concert scenes especially. Because we had Blister, who had done the lead song for Fistful of Brains. And everybody just really enjoyed it. Everybody enjoyed being the hippies.
Well, especially those that grew up in that, you know, around that time, you know, it was something to go for. But I mean, but you got a lot of the youngsters in there probably like, oh man, put me in the psychedelic clothes. I'll do it, man. You know, and they're probably just loving it.
Everybody just wanted to wear tie-dye.
And I don't know. The funny thing, it's like a lot of these college students, though, sometimes if they do an 80s party and they wear these retro 80s things, and I look at them thinking, you know, very few people wore exactly that where I was around in the 80s.
Yes, exactly.
So it makes me wonder when I see these movies that do things that are funny, like the 50s or 60s, I'm starting to wonder now after all these years, I'm like, wait a minute, maybe really people didn't wear like all those. Oh, well, it's an aside.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I like it. Now, is there ever going to be, you know, because the Italian Westerns, you know, had the third part.
Yeah.
Are you going to do your version of the good, the bad, and the zombie?
No, I don't think we're going to do that one. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I had a feeling because it's been, the second one came out 11 years ago. So I was thinking, I think that the ship had sailed, but there was always what you never know.
That was the original plan, but a few brains more just, you know, wore us out. And we were like, that's it. You know, we're going to just end it on that one.
And we've mentioned Bill. You started working with him when you were back in college, learning those things then. Yeah. That's how you met.
Yeah.
And how many films have you done with Mr. Mulligan? I mean, you've done quite a few where he's been either a writer or an actor or, you know, special effects.
Yeah. And he's even directed a few of them too. So I think, you know, he's been part of all my movies. I don't think there's one that he hasn't been a part of. Yeah.
I guess once you got attached to him, you didn't know it was going to be a lifetime thing, you know, nor did he.
I can't get rid of him now, you know, he's just always there.
And he's probably saying, if you did a script, he's like, oh, can I take a look at the script for a rewrite? You know, the next thing you know, oh, look, there's this, a new character's in there.
I know who can
play him. I know the guy that's perfect for him. It's a doctor professor type. It'd be perfect for, you know, a guy that's from New York. But as much as I'm joking about, he does an excellent job of playing the roles that he does. I mean, it's like, I think he knows his niche and he just.
He does. He might be a little bit typecast there, but he's really good at that part.
And there's nothing wrong with typecasting as long as it gets your roles.
That's right.
And speaking of that, you guys worked together on 400 Ways to Kill a Vampire. I'm about to say a vampire for some reason. I'm thinking zombies. I'm starting to combine them together.
Vampires.
And I love that short. That was to me awesome. And I think everybody, it's on YouTube if I remember correct, right?
It is. Yeah, it's on our Sick Chick Flicks YouTube page.
For this October, because this will be coming out later this month, definitely see this by Halloween. I think it's 22, 24 minutes long. It's a short. It goes right to it. It's enjoyable. What can you say about the production and the working on 400 Ways to Kill a Vampire?
It was a lot of fun. Especially for us, maybe not so much for the actors, especially poor Michael Williams, who had to sit tied to that tree surrounded by real hawthorn bushes, you know, and it was cold and it smelled like coyote pee. And it was just, and then we had the stump holes that everybody kept falling into, but, it was fun. It's always a lot of fun when we get together. That's why we keep doing it. You know, it was cold and it was dark and, you know, we were there very late, but in the end, we enjoyed it.
Like I said, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's pretty much, for the most part, a two-person, you know, acting together. Bill as, Vordenberg and Michael as Eddie. You know, it's mostly the two of them. But you do have, it's a small cast, the four. And I just like how he's torturing him with, it's like, well, you're going to die this way. And this is the way, it's so matter of fact and scholarly. And when he encounters the other vampires, how he handles it is just so, it's like, he's almost like clinically detached on how he goes about it.
One thing about Bill is he loves to write dialogue. There was actually a lot more dialogue to that. It probably would have ended up being 30 minutes if I'd put it all in. He was a little hurt that I had to cut some of his dialogue, but it just went on too much.
And that's the thing is, as you know, is being, because you wrote a lot of these things too, and you can't fall too much in love with anything. And I think all filmmakers, you got to look at it from the other perspective. Like, oh, I want to keep this scene, but is it moving everything?
Is it really with the sport? Yeah, you got to kill some of your darlings sometimes. Yeah.
And Bill had to learn that the hard way.
Yes. It's not the first time he's learned that.
Well, I mean, you know, Bill is Bill, and I had him on the show and do an interview, and he's going to come back for a movie discussion and that we're going to do. We have to get that scheduled, and he's just such a nice guy and really knows his stuff.
Oh, man, does he ever. Yeah.
Now, the next movie I was going to bring up with you is that I've seen. Is your last movie, but yeah. We can go back and talk about some of the other movies. I was trying to hit movies where I have definitely seen, and that's okay. Blood of the Mummy, which came out a few years ago. I think just before the pandemic, right?
Right. Yeah.
And that's available, I believe, on Amazon Prime.
It's on Amazon. Tubi. Yeah, it's on a few things.
Yeah, because I saw it earlier this year. I really enjoyed it. And I could say, for you as a filmmaker, I could see how, you know, as you look at the first one that I saw into this one, I can just see how you've improved so much, you know, going
through. Thank you so much. I certainly hope so.
And I'm not saying your early work was bad. I just, I look at that as like, this is her first movie, she's learning, and you can see how, like 15 years later or whatever it is, you know, when Blood of the Mummy came out, it's like, oh, you could just see the progression of filmmaking. So what was it like doing Blood of the Mummy? Because I mean, it's for those who haven't seen, it's a really good mummy movie.
That was a joy. I mean, it really was. Everything just seemed to, you know, fall into place. I wouldn't say it was effortless because Bill will tell you it took hours to wrap that mummy, but we got the perfect cast. We got the perfect locations. We had funding, you know, the best funding we've ever had. And I mean, everything just turned out exactly how I wanted it to, other than not being able to go to Egypt and shoot it, you know, it was beautiful.
There's budget, then there's realistic budget. There's a lot of filmmakers that wish they could go to Egypt to film, and they end up in some desert area in the United States.
I knew some cameramen from the film festival who were in Egypt, and I actually tried to get them to get some shots for me, but they couldn't get the permits to do it, so we couldn't get them.
That's the one great thing now of modern technology is it would have pulled off because everything being digital and knowing the people.
Yeah.
But you had a good cast. Laura Bridges plays one of the versions of Louise, the older one. It's for most of the movie, but the other two did a great job also. But how did you find her? How did she end up getting cast?
Well, we did a casting call. And, you know, we wanted someone that looked similar because we had already cast the teenage version of Louise. And we wanted someone that looked similar to her, you know, that could pull it off. And she didn't look exactly like we thought she should look for Louise, and that she had blue eyes, you know. But she was by far the best actress. So, we told her, you know, we would really like to cast her the part, but the eye color was a problem. She's like, well, I can just wear contacts. So I was like, yeah, I guess you could wear contacts. So, you know, so we went ahead and went with her. That's what our gut told us, is that she should be the one.
Yeah, and then, you know, the contact thing that made it all mute then with the eye color thing. I mean, if for some reason, if you still would have cast her and she had the blue eyes, you could have made some kind of line where her eyes changed colors and, you know, magic, mystic, whatever.
Yeah. That's just a pet peeve of mine. When I see movies and the kid has blue eyes and then grows up and they have brown eyes, I'm like, come on now. You couldn't find an actor that had the same color eyes. That just doesn't make sense.
Especially if you know who the actor is going to be and you can go reverse and if the child is the one who's going to be there for a short period of time, you know, it's.
Yeah.
You could go the opposite way, you know. But at least you didn't get rid of the child actor. You could have did the op. You could have been like the cruel one. It's like, oh no, we like her a lot. We're just going to get another version of you. And be like, what? You promised. I know. Justin Cole as a theme. as I like Tim, I like how you had, I don't want to spoil the movie, but there are twists in it, and there are things, and I like how they, some of these characters play part in the movie, and I guess, you know, some of these, like with, you know, Albert Guzman playing Mehmet, he was so cool in doing it, because he felt like a character that you would have seen back in the old Universal movies. And so how did you find him? Because when you found him, I mean, that was just like, I mean, in North Carolina, of all places, you find somebody that could have fit in a Universal movie. I was just flabbergasted.
He's an excellent actor, and he does a lot of theater. We first met him on A Few Brains More. He was one of the background actors that showed up. He was one of the guys that got killed with a knife in his head. So, that's when we first formed that relationship, and we've been friends with him for ever since. And actually the guy that financed the film, asked if we could find a part for him in the movie because, you know, he loved Albert as well. And we were like, well, of course, you know, he's an excellent actor. We would love to have him in the movie. So that just seemed like a perfect part for him. He has a lot of range, and he's a very sweet man too. He's not really that evil.
Well, yeah, I hope everybody knows that people are except for Bill. Bill might be the only person that actually plays himself. Yeah, he might actually play himself. But the rest are not that way in real life.
Yeah.
Bill, I hope you know, I'm doing this with love. Don't take anything personal.
Yeah.
But he has a good sense of humor, so I think he would.
He does.
So, The Mummy. Bill said, I mean, you said it already. Bill, I think, even said it took a long time to do it. But Terrence Watson, you know, anybody that gets wrapped up and has to spend, I don't know how long it took Bill to wrap him up. I can't remember now, but that is for an actor to get the makeup put on. What was it like finding him? And what do you think of the look of The Mummy in the movie?
Well, I mean, we actually had three people playing The Mummy. Terrence Watson was our main guy because he was almost 7 feet tall. You know, he just towered over Louise, you know. But and it was a very long process for him, and it was difficult for him to spend that much time just sitting waiting for the bandages to get done. It was difficult for all of us because we were like, have you got The Mummy done yet? We want to start shooting something, you know. And we tried a couple of different things to just create like mummy suits, but in the end it was just, you know, we had to wrap him. And I was worried about, you know, not being consistent, you know, not having the mummy look exactly the same every time. But, you know, I think it kind of worked in the end.
I think if people are doing a low budget film and there's like, oh, they're not keeping the continuity, they probably are not into this movie to begin with. You know, for big budgets where you have millions and millions of dollars, yeah, you can have it exactly the same. You have a team of people just doing the mummy makeup. Your team was like, what, Bill?
Yeah. One guy. Well, Bill and Sierra. Yeah.
Yeah, two people.
And Daphne, Peter. But they weren't always there at the same time. So sometimes we just had one, sometimes we had the others, you know.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's, if you have one person, you know, and we're Hollywood, you know, they got like 10 people doing it. It's
exactly,
it's not
yeah.
the same. But if you can give a brief synopsis of what the movie's about, you know, so that way people can go, if they go to watch it, they'll know.
Yeah, so my whole goal with this was to tell the mummy story from the perspective of the woman in the film, because, you know, a lot of the old mummy films, it's all about the guy saving the girl from the mummy and it's more their story. But I wanted to show what the young woman went through being stalked by this mummy who's obsessed with her and believes that she's his lost love. So, that was really, I wanted to like show, you know, from the very beginning, what happened to her and her relationship with this mummy and what she goes through. And then, you know, find out exactly how it came to be, if she really was his princess or if she's just somebody who he thought looked like her. And it's kind of almost like a stalking story, but also a love story, you know, like mm-hmm. a stalking slash love story. So I think it turned out well in that aspect.
It's almost like you could have called it Love of the Mummy, you know, or Blood of the Mummy. Yeah. Like it does have that. I agree with you. It does have that. I'm trying to think of different ways of saying love. That bad version of love, you know, where like you said, the stalker obsession. Of. There we go. Obsession of the Mummy. That would have. Yeah. But I don't, Blood of the Mummy, and there is some gore in there. So there is some blood.
And it is all about the blood, and you know that's the connection right there. So.
And for those wondering, Bill Mulligan plays a psychiatrist. Yes, like we said, a doctor or a professor. That's usually Bill.
Yeah. And in this case, he did not write the part for himself. I wrote this part for him.
Okay, but you know, he does a good job. I mean, he goes through. He plays a psychiatrist well. You just believe he can. He is. So it's
really a very good psychiatrist, but you know.
Well, you know. Not everybody can be great at their job, you know, and that
kind of stuff. Yeah, he doesn't really work in the best place, so, you know, he's kind of limited.
Now, I know we jumped over a lot of your shorts and other things. Not everything was I was able to see prior to interviewing you, but what are some of the things that you wanted to bring up that you worked on that you really wanted to highlight so that also the people can see? I think a lot of these are available on Sick Chick Flicks on YouTube, right?
Yes. One of my favorites is Telltale Heart Sisters. That's one that I would love to highlight because I really enjoyed the way that turned out. And I think I stayed pretty true to Poe's story. I used a lot of his words. I had to modernize some of them, of course. But it's kind of a tip to whatever happened to Baby Jane mm-hmm. and the relationship between two sisters. So, you know, a couple of my favorite things. And we did it in black and white, which I love working in black and white.
So when you were working in the black and white, were you taking advantage of the shadows and things like that to try to get that north?
Lots of contrast and shadowy shots and And we had a really cool place to work in, too. It was like this Bellamy Manor. It's this big old, I don't know if it's colonial time period, but it's a really old house. They have it as a bed and breakfast, and they let us use it for the weekend. It was a lot of fun.
I'm going to definitely watch that one before October for Halloween.
Okay.
I try to watch all these things, but you didn't know. I'm interviewing four people in 5 days. So five people in 3 days. So a lot of these, you know, you're trying to watch as much as you can for everybody. Yeah. And you're one of the three filmmakers. And that's when you hit the thing. When you hit three different filmmakers, it's like, oh my, it's amazing how much work you guys put out.
Yeah.
So I was picking and choosing stuff and I saw that one won an award.
Yeah, it's won a couple of awards actually. Yeah.
So it's definitely one. And being a Baltimore guy, I don't know why. I don't know how I jumped over. I think I wanted to go back to it, and then I put a feature in instead of that, and then just sadly ran out of time to fit it in. It's like you don't want to try to. I try to put myself in the best viewing mode possible to watch the stuff. So that way it's like, I get the film, you know, you don't want to be like tired when you're watching something. You want to be as most receptive to it and that kind of thing. So I can judge it the best way. But I'm definitely, cause I live near Baltimore, so I got to watch it cause it's Poe. But what other shorts or features did we jumped over that you want us to highlight? I mean, that one definitely.
Yeah, Fix It in Post. That was a really fun film. And that was more sci-fi, I think, than horror. It had zombies in it, but they weren't real zombies. So well, except toward the end there. But that was a lot of fun. It was about a group of filmmakers that are making a zombie film, and right in the middle of it, an EMP hits and knocks out the whole power grid all over the earth. So they're stranded out there. Their cars won't work. So they have to survive using their filmmaker skills, you know. And basically, you know, the food stores are getting emptied, so they dress up a bunch of people as zombies, you know, to go raid the food stores. And now everybody thinks the zombie apocalypse is here. So, just like this whole comedy of errors, you know, stuff that happens to them as they're trying to bumble their way through the apocalypse.
So they try to do like what Bill Murray did. I'll just dress as a zombie and then, you know.
Exactly. But it doesn't always work out very well because there's like these rednecks who kind of are very territorial and they think that they need to kill these zombies, you know. Oh, then they have to, yeah. I can't tell you too much because it would give too much away, but it's a fun story. There's a lot of different elements to it.
Well, that's good because and see now I think we're hitting people's little boxes if they're listening at home they're writing down these things to watch, and that's the good thing.
And to go
seek them out. What are you working on currently? You working on anything that you can talk about?
I'm not working on anything personally. I've been more working with other people in my group, a lot of the women to kind of encourage them to make their own films. I've had a few of them writing scripts, and my friend Angela Giddings, who runs the film festival with me, she's just directed her first short film. So I've been helping her with editing that, and I think she's in getting it scored right now and getting some effects done by Bill, and hopefully we'll have it out soon. And then we've got a couple more scripts with Sierra Dahl, who's a special effects person on Blood of the Mummy, one of the special effects people. She's written a couple of scripts, and, you know, hopefully that's what we're going to be doing over the next year is directing or giving them to direct their film.
So you're moving on to a support mentor role for a little while now to get stuff out.
Yeah. So it's not all about me, you know, it's all about them and empowering them to make their own movies and tell their stories.
And I think that's important because a lot of filmmakers don't have that support or don't have that thing to network. And you're out there doing that, you know, guiding. And just because you're saying this is what worked for you doesn't mean it's going to work for them, but at least you can share that experience and say, well, I've done this. This is what happened. You can still go that way if you want, but I would highly recommend you go this way.
Right. It's important to pass that knowledge on. I mean, I'm not getting any younger and I want to be able to pass this on to people so they can carry it on.
Well, hopefully after you do that, you know, for a little while, like supporting, you get that bug again and want to put some more films out because, I mean, as much as I enjoy Blood of the Mummy, I don't want it to be your last film that you direct.
There was some talk about doing Mask of the Red Death, which would be a lot of fun.
Well, you should continue to do those talks.
Especially considering what's happened in the past few years, huh?
So you should continue to do those talks.
Yeah. We even found a really good location, and I want to kind of give it a kind of a Dr. Fives kind of feel to it, you know? I think it would be a lot of fun. I think mostly for me, it's money. It's just the whole fundraising is so exhausting. And without having a really good budget, I don't want to do it half-assed, you know?
Oh, I know. And I've talked to many independent filmmakers. A couple of them are close friends of mine, and the budget put always trying to get the financing to get it is so tough.
It is hard, especially when you're raised not to beg people for money, you know. So you feel like guilty asking people for money to make your movie, but you definitely don't want to use your own money. That will just get you into all kinds of trouble.
Well, I know. Talking with them, well, sometimes they'll have DVDs or Blu-rays out, or when their movie first comes out, it'll be streaming, but people have to pay for it. And I know people will say, oh, I'll just wait till it's on a free streaming service. And I always try to remind people, and I'm going to remind them now, listeners, if you have to pay a few dollars to rent the movie, It's just like back in the days of Blockbuster, which we all used to do. But except this case, a lot more money goes to the filmmaker to make their next film. So if you really enjoy their film, rent it or buy it. And if you have the physical media, buy a copy because they get even more money to make the next film. The streaming amount they get currently at the rate they're getting them, it's a pittance. It's a pittance, and it would take a gazillion views for it to actually mount to something. And really, if you see Christine's work out there and you want to, and you see there's a rental thing, and do it. You know, I mean, yeah, you could say, well, in a few months it'll be free, but then again, if you like what the people are doing, try to support them in those ways, and that way you don't have to worry about them begging you for money. You're just saying, no, here's my money. Take it, please. Make more. Make the Mask of Red Death. Come on, do it. Because I just hate it when independent filmmakers don't get the support they do, and people just think, oh, why see it in the theater, or why get this when I can get it for free? And it's just, I don't know. It's just,
yeah. Sad. I mean, it's not because there's so many independent filmmakers now. I mean, everybody can make films now, and they're all asking for money. So, you know, that's what's hard is, you know, people only have so much. You can't keep going to the same pool of people. You have to find more people.
And the good part with you is you have a body of work that people can see. It's like, okay, she has a new movie coming out. Should I buy it or rent it or whatever? Well, I've liked a lot of her other films that I've seen, or all the other films. Well, then if you know, it's like, you're going to do it. It's like, if it was Steven Spielberg, you wouldn't hesitate. And he's got a gajillion amount of money, but you know, the independent filmmakers, for some reason, they're like, oh, we'll just wait. I mean, yeah, they need our support even more than, way more than the Spielbergs. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with going to a Spielberg movie. I'm just saying, if you had to choose between the two, choose the one that really, really needs the money.
Yeah, I agree. 100%.
But I want to thank you for joining me to talk, you know, for a little bit about, you know, some of your movies that you've done and that kind of stuff and have coming out. And I'm really hoping that people will help support, you know, Sick Chick Flicks production, because that way we can get more movies that are done with a female point of view out there. And, and you need to get that support. And I think that's the key thing. And I, for those wondering what was at the festival, when you're listening to this, it's probably going to still be on their website, what was this past schedule, which just happened. And you can see, like I did, I looked down, I was like looking at all these different movies. And I live a little distance from North Carolina, but I was like, man, if I would have been there, I would have saw this one. I would have liked to have seen that one. This, okay, yeah. And I mean, it was probably like, just from reading the descriptions, at least 20 of the movies I was saying, oh, that this would interest me. And that's the nice thing about going to festivals, is that you can see a lot of films in a short period of time.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, just an amazing body of work of filmmakers from all over the world, you know, really, really, really cool thing to be able to see.
And we discussed the winners, discounting all the people that won an award. What was one of the films that you really enjoyed that did not win an award that you might want to, you know, throw a shout out to them?
I mean, there are so many of them. I hate to just pick one out because...
you can pick a couple if you want.
I mean, all of these women made excellent films. And honestly, I kind of feel like the ones that I really liked are the ones that won, you know? Even though I wasn't one of the judges, you know, me and Angela, we curate these and whittle it down to the ones we're going to show and then pass it on to the judges. So, you know, I really think they pick the best ones. And I do try to not just pick one film that wins a bunch of the same awards. I do try and kind of spread it out on purpose, because I want to see a lot of filmmakers recognized, a lot of different filmmakers.
And that does, and those awards do help, because it helps get them sometimes to the next festival, and then sometimes they're able to get a distribution deal or whatever.
That, yeah.
A good distribution deal, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Because some of them, some distribution companies are just evil.
A lot of distribution companies are evil.
That's what I hear. You know, I was trying to be nice. I shouldn't be nice with them. It's just, whatever. They just like screwing people over that labor under love. And
yeah, that's the bad thing is you don't really make money, you know, especially on short films. Even features, you don't. But a lot of people get to see it. So you're really making these films for love, not for money. You know, for love of doing it.
Now, next year, if you want, when you know mm-hmm. what films you're going to have at the next festival, if you want to come back on the show, we can talk about the festival, and then you can pick a movie that we can discuss. That's something that you know that's not at that festival. That's you know any movie you want, and that way we can get people to remember. Hey, come to the festival if you're interested.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, I would love to do that.
So listeners, Christine will be back next year, but this time you'll have enough notice to go to North Carolina and you'll be able to go to the festival and she might come up with an award if you decide to go for it to 12 hours of all the blocks.
Yeah.
Maybe she'll have a little check, like a little card for people like she can know. Like, okay, you did this one, like a little check off thing, you know, like little.
Yeah, yeah.
A card coupon thing. You know, if you do that, somebody's going to do it just to win the award. That's the beauty of it all.
Exactly.
But thanks again, Christine, for joining me.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me here.
I hope everybody enjoyed that. As you heard during the interview, I was hoping to get this episode out late October, but for reasons, it came out this month. So I hope everybody still enjoyed it, and I hope everybody takes time to go look for her movies on YouTube or on Amazon Prime and gives them a watch. If you have feedback, please send us emails at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. I want to thank everybody for listening and remind everybody that Diecast Movie Podcast is also the home of Hammerama. And for those wondering what Hammerama is about, I'll let you listen to the promo as we exit the episode. So I hope everybody enjoys and has a good day. Bye.
I'm Al from New Zealand.
And I'm Stephen from Maryland, USA.
We are Hammerama. Welcome to our new podcast. Enter freely and of your own will.
Part of the multi-award-nominated diecast movie podcast, Hammerama is a wide look at the world of Hammer horror from either side of the globe.
Each month, we will throw a die to decide which category from the film vault of Hammer we are going to discuss. The Dracula, Frankenstein, or Mummy Cycles, science fiction, prehistory, or the experimental 1970s.
We will cast our international eyes across then and now reviews of the movie,
its place in the Hammerverse,
our encounters with the stars,
a film poster critique,
and unusual associated merchandise.
So join us for our bite-sized discussion of Hammer's gory glories, stitched together from both ends of the earth.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.